Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by the Coriell Institute for Medical Research.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Lindsay Aikman is a high school teacher in Champaign, Illinois at Centennial High School.
So I've been a teacher for 15 years.
Often, Lindsay finds herself worrying about much more than her students' understanding of literature and grammar. Gun violence in Champaign has been increasing. Last December, three people were shot outside a high school basketball game. A student shared with her that he's worried and afraid of dying all the time. So Lindsay decided she needs to learn how she can help her students cope and how she can support kids who are traumatized.
We have kids walking around with chronic PTSD. We have kids like repressing the violence that they've seen, the fear that they have of not graduating. We've got to do better. There has to be better.
Along with other educators, she recently attended a training about the effects of trauma on the brain.
Having a caring school environment, me liking school, is a protective factor that helps me overcome all kinds of adversity.
That's Karen Sims. She is a mental health counselor who runs this training.
You can go home and have a lot of disruption if 8 hours a day somebody likes you.
Across the country, educators are increasingly paying attention to public health issues that they feel are preventing their students from learning, from succeeding in the classrooms. And schools are getting more involved in healthcare, providing basic medical and dental services or counseling right there in school. On today's episode, what role can and should schools play in caring for kids' health? Before you send your kids to school, you have to take care of this.
Which one's your left?
Vaccines.
Shh. You're going to be all right.
You'll be fine. Watch. 1, 2, 3.
You can show your eyes, though.
Most schools in the U.S. require vaccinations and records documenting that students have gotten all of their shots. If parents want to opt out, they have to get an exemption. But how did we get there? How did schools become enforcers of vaccine policies? Reporter Avi Wolfman-Arendt is here now, and he's looked into that long history. Hey, Avi.
Hey, Maiken.
So where does this story begin? When do schools get interested in vaccines?
Well, when you look into the history, it turns out that the relationship between vaccines and schools is about as old as kids having to go to school. In the middle of the 19th century, more states are passing laws that require kids to go to school rather than, you know, working through their childhood.
So this is also the industrial age. Cities are growing. I'm guessing schools are growing.
Yeah.
And then you have a whole bunch of kids in classrooms together.
Exactly, right? And that means they're like swapping germs together. And pretty soon, public health officials know that they've got a problem on their hands. And I talked about this with James Colgrove. He's a historian at Columbia University.
Kids are always more vulnerable to infectious diseases. And when you start to put more and more kids together in the same place, it's a natural response to say, well, we're going to require these kids to be vaccinated. And we are doing this because we don't want to see outbreaks of contagious diseases in our schools.
So in 1855, Massachusetts became the first state to say, you know what, kids can't come to school unless they get the smallpox vaccine, which is the only vaccine available back then.
Did other states do the same thing, follow suit?
Not really. Here's James again.
A few did in a sort of patchwork way. But generally, compulsory vaccination was not so widely used in the middle decades of the 20th century.
The 20th century, so that's a good 100 years after that first vaccine law was passed, and schools were still not requiring vaccinations.
Yeah. School vaccine laws had still not totally caught on by the middle of the 20th century. By 1969, only about half of states had mandatory vaccination laws, and a lot of those were, again, only about smallpox, even though by that point, scientists had invented lots of promising new vaccines.
People mostly welcomed these vaccines and were usually quite eager to get their children to be vaccinated.
But in that same decade, the federal government is growing in size and aspiration, a great society, right? And it wants states to get more in line, be more uniform, and health officials are starting to focus on vaccines, and they're pushing more states to pass laws around them. So Alaska is one of the states that hears this call. And in 1970, lawmakers there make a new rule. They say students have to get vaccinated before coming to school.
Okay, so no shots, no school.
Exactly. And this ends up actually being a real turning point in vaccine history. So a few years after this new vaccine law had passed in Alaska, a 27-year-old medical resident named John Madaw moved to America's last frontier, and he soon found himself right at home.
You know, it was the height of the pipeline boom, and it was just crazy. The state was young, the attorney general was 35 years old, the governor was young, and it's really hard to describe.
John was a minister's son from Baltimore, and by 27, he'd already crisscrossed the globe. He'd ridden motorcycles across the Canadian Rockies, worked medical clinics in rural Ethiopia. And in 1975, the Centers for Disease Control offered him a 2-year gig in Alaska. And the state at the time didn't have an epidemiologist.
And I just thought, wow, I've always wanted to see Alaska, and here's a chance to go up there for 2 years. So I'll get to see the state, and I'll have an adventure.
That adventure started from the moment he touched down in Anchorage, Alaska's biggest city.
And leaving the airport, it turned out that the road was part of the taxiway for small planes, so we were in a line with a Cessna in front of us kicking gravel up into the car, and then we drove into one of the major intersections, and it hadn't been paved yet, and it had been raining, and there were 2 4-wheel drive vehicles stuck in the intersection that were trying to get themselves out of the mud.
In the fall of 1976, Alaska got really interesting. A measles outbreak started in Anchorage and spread throughout the state. John was confused. Hadn't they just passed a law mandating measles shots? He started visiting schools to figure out the situation.
And in this first array of schools that we went to, they virtually didn't have any immunization records, and the ones that they did have were very incomplete. And we're actually dismayed by this and saying, how could this possibly have happened?
There was a vaccine law on the books, but schools weren't following the law.
At the start of that campaign, we identified out of about 100,000 students in the state, there were about 30,000 that were missing some of the vaccines.
John and his colleagues had an idea that, remarkably, hadn't really been tried before. They said, let's actually enforce the law. Or to put it more bluntly, let's kick kids out of school.
I didn't know better. I actually just saw, hey, it's required. These vaccines are safe. We're in the midst of an outbreak. And why aren't we enforcing the requirement?
John called his boss at the Centers for Disease Control to tell him the plan.
And the first comment was that, well, you'll never be able to do that. And I said, why not? And he said, well, people won't support enforcing that.
Okay, a quick history break here. Because young John Madaw's boss had a point. Anti-vaccine attitudes are as old as vaccines, and ever since the 1800s, people tried to block mandatory vaccination laws. The most famous case stemmed from a smallpox outbreak in 1902. To curb the epidemic, the town of Cambridge, Massachusetts, ordered everyone to get vaccinated. Public health historian James Colgrove says eventually that order reached a guy named Henning Jacobson.
The vaccinator came to his house and said, we're here to vaccinate you and your family, and he refused, and they fined him $5.
That's right, $5.
Which in today's money would be probably $100, $150. So, you know, not a huge amount, but you know, if you're a working family, that could be a burden.
We don't actually know a ton about Henning Jacobson. He was a Swedish immigrant and a Lutheran minister.
And apparently his opposition was at least partly rooted in a prior bad experience that he had. So when the vaccinator came to his house, he said, well, several years ago, one of my sons was vaccinated and he had a very bad reaction. And so for that reason, I'm not willing to undergo this again.
Henning Jacobson's case went all the way to the Supreme Court. In other cases, lower courts had disagreed on whether these vaccine laws violated the Constitution. But in a 7-2 decision, the Supreme Court justices said the minister, Henning Jacobson, would have to pay that $5 fine.
So the rationale was really that people who don't want to be vaccinated can present a danger to the community.
But even with the law on their side, lots of states laid off the mandates for decades, thinking it would just be easier for everyone if the government didn't get too involved. And that brings us back to the fall of 1976 and the rough and tumble state of Alaska. Epidemiologist John Madaw and his colleagues were dealing with this measles outbreak, and they were frustrated. So the state made a declaration. Anyone who couldn't prove they'd been vaccinated by March 1st of the following year would be sent home from school. And on that day, the state turned away about 8% of the entire school population of Alaska. And then most families got on board. Within a month, almost every Alaskan school kid had been immunized and the outbreak faded.
And so others rapidly saw that the public was way more supportive of trying to protect kids against vaccine-preventable diseases than anybody had suspected.
Emboldened by their success, the CDC partnered with First Lady Rosalynn Carter on a campaign to expand and enforce vaccination laws. And by 1980, all 50 states required kids to get at least certain vaccinations before entering school.
Many of the states did just what Alaska did and said, nope, it's going to be all kids, all grades, all vaccines.
Dr. John Madaw is 70 now and recently retired, but vaccination law kept evolving long after his Alaska experiment. States started piling on more school vaccine requirements. Allison Buttenheim studies vaccine laws at the University of Pennsylvania and says some moms and dads today are confused by the sheer number of requirements.
Now, you know, I think parents are starting to say like pneumococcal, meningococcal, like I don't even know what those diseases are. Do we really need hep A, hep B? Like how many heps are there?
Remember that in the beginning, these school-based laws were supposed to stop the spread of disease among children. But you might say public health officials got a little greedy. They saw how effective these laws were and started targeting diseases that don't typically spread among kids.
And a lot of parents, I think, that kind of prejudices them against the whole childhood vaccine schedule. Like, you're going to vaccinate my newborn baby today for a sexually transmitted disease that I don't have and I don't expect this kid to be exposed to for a very long time. You know, WTF.
You can feel that sense of WTF in today's opposition to mandatory vaccines. This is a 2015 rally in California where protesters gathered to oppose a change in the state's school vaccine law.
That SB 277 has definitely awoken a sleeping giant.
For years, California let parents opt their kids out of vaccines if they had a religious or philosophical objection. The state removed those exemptions in 2015. Today, if you're trying to avoid getting your kid vaccinated, you have to provide a medical reason. Allison Buttenheim is studying the fallout of all this, and she's not yet sure if the change really worked or if it just made people angrier. She thinks states might be better off letting parents claim religious or personal belief exemptions, but making it harder to get them.
So if you have to go get a healthcare provider signature, if you have to get an affidavit, if you have to get a something notarized, that may be just enough of a hassle factor that it's just easier to go get the kid vaccinated and bring the records into school.
It took a long time for states to get really serious about school vaccination laws. Then they got really serious. Now we're in a moment again where public health experts are wondering how far they can go before hurting their own cause. For The Pulse, I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about schools and health. A lot of parents and teachers are concerned about stress levels among students and how the pressure to succeed and get good grades is impacting kids' mental health. This issue is heating up in Hong Kong, which on the surface seems to have one of the world's best education systems. Students there consistently end up in the top rankings of international tests. But there is a darker side to academic achievement and a culture of test-taking, one that parents are pushing back against. I talked about this with Odilon Cousin. He is a public health consultant who lived in Hong Kong for 9 years. His daughter was born there, and he started worrying about the pressures she faced in school early on.
Lots of writing, lots of worksheets, even in kindergarten. And as the years progressed, it grew exponentially. And it's really quite overwhelming for a young child.
His family moved to England a year ago, in part to get away from this high-pressure school system. Odilon says when they were in Hong Kong, every night his daughter had up to 2 hours of homework to get done. This is in elementary school. And she was getting more and more frustrated. But beyond what was happening in his home, there were bigger problems.
I think most parents keep it in the family. But most parents are actually quite concerned that the kids are under too much pressure, not sleeping enough. And oftentimes we had, when we were there, a spike in suicides among students as young as 9 years old. And I think a lot of parents were really worried when they saw that, although they, again, felt like they couldn't oppose the system. And then there were quite a number of parents, although a smaller group, who were willing to speak out and organize protests and organize open letters that we sent to the Education Bureau, insisting that they do more to reduce the pressure, because the pressure is actually coming from the whole education system and the tests that kids have to take to go from primary school to secondary school to university.
And you and the other parents thought that this intense pressure pushed children into a very dark place, and there was a fallout from that.
Oh, definitely. And there were a number of studies done and surveys done about mental health among students, young and old, and most of them showed a clear correlation between academic pressure and self-harm, depression. We did have a number of meetings with officials in the Education Bureau, but they were really reluctant, and they would always push back and debate and say, you can't prove that that's what caused the student suicide, or you can't prove that that's what's caused so much depression among young kids. And it's true, it's very hard to prove, but you can show statistical correlation, and obviously they don't want to admit, because then they'll have to change their whole system.
What are the stakes, whether they are real or imagined, for kids? So if you don't do well on a test, or you don't have good scores, what happens?
Well, the stakes are very, very real for Hong Kong kids. If you don't do well on a test, you will often not get into the better school. There's a lot of pressure from parents to do well on your test so you can get into the good high school or secondary school. And then there's a single test. It's the number that you get on this test determines if you go to university or not for high school students.
What happens to kids who just are not good at taking tests?
Yeah, the kids who can't do well on tests simply don't move forward in the system. There's very little flexibility.
You're in England now. What are the differences you're seeing in terms of the schooling and what's asked of kids?
The difference is quite stark, actually. When we got here, my daughter was just shocked because there was basically no homework. She went from getting a couple hours a night to getting maybe half an hour a week or 1 hour a week.
And the efforts in Hong Kong, are they ongoing? Are the other parents still at it, trying to change the system?
Absolutely. I'm still on the WhatsApp groups. The push continues. So hopefully, sooner or later, people will realize that there are a lot of negative side effects in addition to the high test scores that kids encounter due as a result of this system.
Odilon Cousin is a public health consultant and he lives in England now. When one of my kids comes home from school and tells me a classmate got sick and threw up at their desk, I immediately ask them, were you sitting close to them? Did you wash your hands a lot today? Parents are always worried about contagious diseases going around in school. Usually, kids who are sick are kept home to keep the other ones healthy. But the question is that always the best option? And how long should kids stay away from the classroom? Reporter and dad Andrew Stelzer looked into changing attitudes and school policies around this issue.
Kumiko Kawasaki may never really know where exactly it happened. Maybe here on this playground in Berkeley, California. It may have been at school, but somewhere along the way, her two children caught hand, foot, and mouth disease three times.
My oldest son actually had twice, so I was pretty familiar with how his symptoms got developed, you know, the fever, the bruises, that kind of thing.
Hand, foot, and mouth disease is a nasty-sounding virus, but it's actually pretty common, especially among young children. Over the past 5 years, Kumiko missed so much work to take care of her children when they were out sick, she's had to quit her job as a social worker and find more flexible part-time employment. This past spring, she got a call from the preschool again. Her two-year-old was one of several new cases of hand, foot, and mouth disease in the class. She picked him up, but back at home, she didn't see any symptoms. So the next day, her husband brought their son back to school.
And the teacher asked him why he's at school.
Kumiko and her husband were following school policy. Their son was symptom-free for 24 hours, and his fever was under 100 degrees. But despite the official protocol, the teachers were nervous.
He was asked if we took him to the doctor and got the clearance about he doesn't have the disease. And then another teacher, another day, asked him the same question.
Kumiko says they felt pressure to take their son out of school. But according to pediatrician Dean Blumberg, keeping a kid home for a few days for hand, foot, and mouth disease doesn't help much to prevent its spread.
Even after they recover, the virus can still be found for up to 6 weeks in their nasal secretions and for several months in their gastrointestinal tract. And so it may be transmitted by asymptomatic children also.
The skin rash, fever, and blisters inside the mouth may be long gone, but the virus can still easily be passed on by kids playing in the same room. Dean is an infectious disease specialist. He says you'd have to keep a child home for weeks, both before and after they had visible symptoms, to really make sure they didn't infect anyone else. That's not realistic for most working families. In fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics, which Dean represents, recommends kids only be kept home for their own comfort. They offer similar advice for lots of illnesses, like pink eye, scabies, and ringworm.
There's really no study that has ever shown that excluding children who are ill, that decreases the rate of transmission and spread to others.
Dean says, in a nutshell, if your kid feels well enough to fully participate, they should probably be at school. That's a big change from a generation or two ago.
The initial policy was based on more hypotheses, and so basically what people thought made sense. Lately, it's been a lot more evidence-based.
The new rules aren't what mom Sarah Kopp expected. Her family lives in Reno, Nevada, and last year, her fourth grader came home scratching her head with, you know what's coming next, yes, head lice.
My daughter has thick blonde hair, and, you know, we would do the shampoo and then have to sit there and pick all the bugs and the eggs out, and it was really, really time-consuming.
Sarah waited until there were no bugs or nits left and then sent her daughter back to school.
And by the end of the week, she had it again.
And again. And again.
Like 8 or 9 months it went on. It was nonstop. I would just treat it, she would go to school, and it would happen again.
Sarah became convinced one of the other children in class was giving her daughter lice. And she was shocked to find out that the Washoe County School District, where she lives, doesn't require students with lice to stay out of school. Sarah says back when she was little, kids were sent home immediately and not allowed back until their heads were inspected by a school nurse.
And then I remember when someone in our class would have head lice, we would all line up outside in the sun, and the teachers and the school nurse would go through everybody's hair to make sure everybody else was clear.
Many school districts still do have that old-fashioned no-nits policy, banning anyone with bugs or eggs in their hair. But pediatrician Dean Blumberg says, it turns out
Lice is just not commonly transmitted in school settings. And children, once they get treated, they can go right back to school.
But mom Sarah Kopp was so frustrated, she started an online petition and gathered 6,000 signatures. She wanted kids sent home until they are treated or lice-free. The school district held firm. Their philosophy is that the need for kids to be in school outweighs any risks associated with lice. Sarah considers herself a punk rock mom, and her daughter eventually dyed her hair purple, which she believes made the lice go away. By the way, there's no medical basis for that claim. As for other parents wondering what they can do to keep their children from catching whatever's going around, the doctor says the best method of prevention, no surprises here, is to teach them to wash their hands. For The Pulse, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Health problems often mean kids are missing school, and eventually they start falling behind, especially if they are dealing with a chronic problem like asthma. Add to that that many kids in the U.S. don't have access to health care, and it becomes a serious problem. In Atlanta, some schools are opening health clinics right inside of their buildings to get kids examined, treated, and right back into the classroom. Martha Dalton has more.
If you're a first grader at Toomer Elementary School in the Edgewood neighborhood of Atlanta, and you're not feeling well, you can walk down the hall and right into the new health center. This is not a school nurse's office where you might get your temperature taken. This is a clinic that offers everything from checkups to immunizations and dental care. Atlanta School Superintendent Maria Carr-Starfin says the idea is to maximize the amount of time a child spends in school.
Kids can't come to school if they don't feel well. Absenteeism is a really serious issue. And so our job is to try to figure out ways to circumvent any reason for a kid not to come to school.
The majority of families here live below the poverty line. In 2017, more than a third of the kids at this school miss more than 5 days during the year. Students who are absent that much tend to get behind in school. This is one of five school-based clinics in Atlanta Public Schools. Maria says in poor communities, even a minor illness can be a big problem for families.
What'll happen is a kid will have a toothache, they feel too sick to go to school, mom still needs 3 days to get them to the doctor, you know, then they keep them at home and they're not going to school, whereas they can come here, get the tooth fixed, go right back to class.
And the clinic doesn't just serve students. All five are open to the communities where the schools are located. These are areas Maria calls medical deserts, where there aren't enough health care providers. The clinics are funded through grant money and corporate donors.
You want to come up here with mama? I'll be right with you, okay?
I'm going to see
you. At another school clinic across town, a mother brings in her toddler for a checkup. Pediatrician Belise Livingston Burns offers him a sticker while he waits.
Okay, Spider-Man, Minion, which one do you like? You want Spider-Man? All right, I'll get you a Spider-Man sticker, okay?
We'll be right back. Belise says she commonly treats kids for stomach bugs and asthma attacks. Asthma is big. Research shows it's the number one reason kids miss school nationwide.
If the parent had to come and pick them up, they could go to their primary care physician or urgent care and maybe have to sit for quite a while, get seen, and then by that time, most of the school day is over.
Instead, Belise can treat the child and send him right back to class. In addition to physical health care, the centers also offer mental health services. Jessica Maddox is a social worker who counsels kids at the clinic. She says many of them have experienced trauma, which can impact their academic progress.
They're usually behind in reading, math, there's a lot of developmental delays, emotional delays, so they do have a harder time self-soothing. So we provide the training on that for parents and teachers and the kids.
She says there is a stigma around mental health services, but she's made it a point to greet all of the families who come into the clinic, and she says she's gained their trust. And she says often they're pleased with the results.
We had one kid who was struggling, but then he got counseling, and then he tested for gifted, and they thought he should have been held back. That's how impactful the counseling was to help him move through those feelings and turn on that other part of his brain.
For The Pulse, I'm Martha Dalton in Atlanta.
Martha reports on education for WABE in Atlanta.
Supporting the Pulse, the Coriell Institute for Medical Research, enabling scientific discovery around the world through its renowned collections of cell lines and DNA from the National Institute on Aging and National Institute for General Medical Sciences. Learn more at coriell.org.
We're talking about schools and health and the role schools can or should play in keeping kids healthy. Onto a topic that can split communities and make for really difficult and awkward school board meetings, sex ed. The military debuted sex ed during World War I as a way to educate soldiers about syphilis and gonorrhea. Not long after, it started popping up in school curriculums. For the most part, it was about the basic biology of sex, preventing STDs and unwanted pregnancies. But over time, ideas about what should be included or not included have changed. Alex Stern graduated from high school in 2011. She identifies as bisexual. And when she looks back on her sex ed classes, she has mixed feelings.
From what I remember, sex ed at my school got off to a rough start. The first lesson came in eighth grade. It was a one-hour class that we had instead of gym, one time. I asked my friend Aubrey Bryan how she remembered it. She was a year behind me in school, but we had the same class. Both of us came out much later, in college.
I don't remember any conversations about condoms, you know, or I think like the classic like banana condom moment never happened.
I know that they talked to the boys about condoms because I remember hearing later. No.
Right. Yeah.
I remember hearing later that that the male gym teacher was like, "Oh yeah, like wear a condom," and then they all kind of laughed about it and then they played basketball for the rest of the period.
Oh my God, that is absolutely what happened. Yeah, so in the girls' room, we talked about, like, how not to get raped, I guess? Or,
I mean, I feel like I could, like, list the scenarios that she told us that you could get raped in. Yeah.
She also had the conversations about, like, how to wear your hair. Because someone could grab your ponytail.
Oh, God. Yeah, but, so, like, it's not that I don't think that those are things that people shouldn't hear. But also, like, I don't know. I think that's probably not what I want from sex ed immediately.
Scare tactics.
There's one other thing that stands out in my memory. The only time queer sex came up in that hour was around HIV and AIDS. Our teacher told us gay men were more likely to contract it because their sex included, quote, ripping and tearing. Aubrey and I agreed we would have liked that conversation to go differently because it made being gay seem dangerous and even violent. But also because we could probably have used some real information on safe sex in different types of relationships. Studies find that young queer women have higher rates of STDs. Sex ed in high school was a lot more serious, a whole marking period, with class every day. Aubrey remembers the anatomy drawings she was supposed to fill out.
It was one of those crappy line drawings where for like the urethra and vagina and anus, it was just like three dots.
I remember there being a breakdown of different forms of contraception. I know we watched a video of a woman giving birth, and that I very conveniently had to go to the bathroom during the actual birth scene. Neither Aubrey nor I remember any discussion about LGBTQ sex that year.
I do really wish there was some acknowledgement of queer sex in a healthy way. Some acknowledgement of those identities. 'Cause I wasn't out at all, like even really aware of that identity for myself.
But when we were in high school, marriage equality hadn't passed yet. LGBTQ people were beginning to be more accepted, but not in the same way that we are now. The Me Too movement hadn't happened, and conversations about sexual assault and harassment sounded a lot different. So I was curious if things had changed since then. I took a train back to my old high school in New Jersey to find out.
How does it feel?
My health teacher, Mr. Dan Dortone, still teaches sex ed there. I met up with him in the front of the building.
Hey, good. How are you? Good to see you.
You too.
Mr. Dortone told me that some new topics have been added to the syllabus and that others have been changed. For example, the district has a pretty low pregnancy rate, so they've dropped some of the material about the consequences of getting pregnant. That birthing video is also long gone.
YouTube has a lot of birthing videos, so if they're interested, look it up and fly, guys. You can see whatever you want to watch.
It's a little less science-heavy now.
We've minimized the biology stuff. We've added more to the sense of consent and relationships, healthy relationships, dating violence.
He says the shift in culture has definitely impacted the class, including the way they talk about consent.
the Me Too movement has really put into overdrive. We spend probably a good 4 or 5 classes discussing how to obtain consent, what's verbal consent.
Mr. Dortone says that LGBTQ identities were on the syllabus the year I took sex ed, but they've expanded on it. For example, 5 years ago, he started bringing in a speaker who's trans. But he says the biggest difference now is actually what the students walk into the room already knowing.
Their exposure is higher, so their understanding, I feel like, is getting deeper and with less pushback.
That means the conversations he has with them can be more complex. I was curious if this evolution was typical across the country, so I got in touch with Al Vernacchio. He has a book called For Goodness Sex, Changing the Way We Talk to Teens About Sexuality, Values, and Health. He's also been a sex educator for over 30 years. First, I told him about my memories of sex ed.
So it sounds very standard for 5 to 10 years ago. I think in many places it is still pretty standard today. I think a lot of sexuality education in the U.S. is still fear-based and heavy on biology and about avoiding negative consequences.
Al says a good sex ed curriculum should be based on the idea that sex is normal, natural, and a positive part of being human. It should include consent, and
we certainly have to talk inclusively about gender and sexual orientation and ability and ethnicity and religion and all the different factors that can influence the way somebody approaches sexuality and makes decisions about it. So, we do need to talk about the basic sex ed stuff.
Stuff like pregnancy, avoiding pregnancy, and STDs. Al and my old health teacher, Mr. Dortone, both cover all that in their classes, but it's still pretty rare. Sex ed isn't even mandatory in more than half the country. I'm a little jealous of the kids at my high school now. They get a chance to learn about sex in a different way, a chance to really examine all the assumptions we bring into the bedroom about consent and gender, roles and identity, and analyze them. I think, as a bi person and as a woman, those kinds of conversations would have been valuable for me as an adult. For The Pulse, I'm Alex Stern.
So sex ed is only mandated in half of all states, and what is taught varies wildly across the country. In California, a new law mandates that sex ed be LGBTQ inclusive. But as those new requirements are rolling out across the state, there's been some fierce opposition, not just against the new requirements, but against sex ed in general. And the pushback is coming from a place you might not expect it, the liberal Bay Area, particularly some Silicon Valley suburbs. Reporter Sandhya Dirks has been covering this, and she joins us now to talk more. And Sandhya, you have been looking at this controversy in Fremont.
Yes.
What happened there? Why were so many parents coming out to talk about this issue and to be at school board meetings?
So hundreds of parents who'd be showing up at these meetings that would last until the early morning. Well, I think one thing that you have to understand about Fremont is the demographics. It's an ethnoburb. It's increasingly diverse. It's 50% Asian, mostly Chinese and South Asian. And its schools, the students are 70% Asian. Many of the parents grew up in different cultures, and those were, you know, many of the parents who came up and were opposed. So there was a real culture clash. Here's one of the parents. Her name is Sylvia Wong.
They even talk about lovemaking positions. They talk about sexual intercourse. These things, I'm even ashamed to talk about it. I'm 45-year-old. I don't want my 10-year-old girl to be involved in that.
So if parents don't want their kids to hear that kind of information, could they opt out of sex ed rather than battling against the course?
Yes, they can totally opt out. That's always been a kind of part of the system. But, you know, parent after parent said that wouldn't work. The parent you just heard from, Sylvia Wong, she thought that even the current curriculum as it stands was too much. She opted her daughter out. But, you know, kids do talk.
She told me one day that, Mom, I know all these things already because kids who attended the class talk about things like that. It's so gross. You know, that just took away my innocence. When I heard that, I was really angry.
I will say that on the other side, you know, parents who were really pro the sex education said, look, kids do talk, and that's why we need to have this.
So Was this a conversation about the new lesson plan specifically? Were there aspects that parents were opposing? Or was this really a conversation about sex ed all around?
You know, I think it was all of those things. I mean, some objected to what they said was explicit material. They said that, you know, a lot of this material was too explicit for kids that were too young to handle it and understand it. Others were more concerned about LGBTQ inclusive education, including, you know, teaching about transgender students. There was a parent named Terry Topham who objected to lessons that she felt, you know, taught young people that they can choose their gender.
My religion prescribes that all human beings, male and female, are created in the image of God, and gender is an essential characteristic of individual identity and purpose.
Sandhya, what kind of arguments were people making in favor of having inclusive sex ed classes that speak to experiences of people who are gay or trans and so on?
Many teachers, many parents, and a lot of students came out to support and rally around the sex ed curriculum. And for example, there was Anthony Prickett, who attended Fremont Unified School District, and he got up there and he said, "Look, I am a proud gay Chinese Christian man." And somebody in the crowd actually yelled out no, which is why he believes that this really needs to be taught to all kids.
Quite often we pit Chinese Americans and Christians against gay people, when in reality there have always been and will always be Chinese Christian gay people.
Where does sex ed stand in Fremont now? What's been the fallout from all of this?
Well, you know, the community got really divided for a while, but they've come back together. They are going to bring back sex ed in 4th through 6th grades. They had canceled it briefly, and they've actually formed a community, task group to do that. This has really divided and split and shook a lot of communities in California coming into compliance with this new law, exposed a lot of fault lines along LGBTQ communities, along kind of how to teach kids about sex. And it makes sense. Sex is personal.
Sandhya, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sandhya Dirks is a reporter for KQED, and she hosts the podcast American Suburb. You're listening to The Pulse. We're talking about schools and the role they play in keeping kids healthy. Ever since the 1950s, American presidents have worried about the fitness level of American children. Were they falling behind kids in other countries? Were kids in the Soviet Union stronger and faster? Here's John F. Kennedy addressing the nation's schools.
This should be a matter of concern to us all. A country is as strong, really, as its citizens.
His successor, Lyndon Johnson, established what came to be known as the Presidential Physical Fitness Test. Students performed sprints, sit-ups, push-ups, pull-ups, stretches, and a one-mile run. And for those who scored better than 85% of their peers, they made the team, so to speak.
Introducing the youngest, smallest, lightest, newest, strongest All-America team, the President's All-America Physical Fitness Team. 50,000 kids made it last year at school. Can you make the team and win this badge from the president? You'll never know unless you try out.
The Presidential Physical Fitness Award was a blue circular badge with a golden eagle and stars in the center. But it's been 6 years since students faced this test. It was phased out amid criticism about its effectiveness. It's been replaced with a new program. Now that its half-century reign over gym class has ended, Jad Slayman headed to a Brooklyn park to ask people who took the test how they remembered it and which parts they would rather forget.
It's a busy day at the park. Kids play ball and chase each other around swing sets and monkey bars. The grown-ups watch, sipping coffee and glancing at their phones. Every adult I talk to here remembers taking the fitness test under one president or another.
I guess it would have been Bush.
I think Ronald Reagan's name was on it.
Bill Clinton.
That's Gabriela Sorales. She's about to turn 30. She took the test for the first time around the 4th grade.
I feel like I remember seeing the president's signature and being like, wow, this is important. Like,
don't let Bill Clinton down.
Yeah, maybe. It felt like they made it kind of grandiose, like it was like a big deal. Like the whole school is participating, this is something the whole country does.
Gabriella hated the push-ups and sit-ups.
I think with the push-ups I actually didn't do anything and would just like kind of pretend I was doing them.
But in general, the test didn't really bother her. Some events she even looked forward to.
Like the forward stretch one, the reason I remember that one is because I remember being like, yeah, I did better than like the average or whatever. And I think that was exciting to me. I was a young kid who ran around a lot. I had three brothers and like, I think just like my family's like a very active family.
She says she'd prefer the test still be around, but with a more relaxed attitude, with lower stakes.
I don't know, it felt so like, it's like such a big deal, like letting the president down if you do bad at this. It's a lot for a kid to handle.
Another woman I talked to, Sayana Leshley, tells me she wasn't worried about the president when she took the test. Instead, she was worried about what her classmates were thinking.
I was always chubby growing up. Push-ups were like the most horrifying thing. Each person would go while everyone else sat around. I just remember everyone watching me as I'm like barely making like three push-ups.
She says she was actually an active kid, playing on basketball and baseball teams.
But in regards to like these specific tasks of like how many pull-ups, like you have to do like 20 pull-ups and like 20 push-ups and like run laps or whatever, like I could never do that.
And she says her gym class didn't prepare the kids for the test at all.
We had 2 weeks to like prep for it. Like they'd be like, oh, we have this coming up then. So like try and get ready to the best of your ability. But you can't really like change your fitness in 2 weeks.
That was actually one of the stubborn criticisms of the test. It kind of just came and went for a few days, once or twice a year, without much reinforcement or training in between. Those who happened to be good runners got great times. Flexible kids got good stretch scores. But the test didn't really change how fit kids were, so much as simply measure snapshot ability. If you happen to already be pretty athletic as a kid, that snapshot could be a big motivator.
You'll never know unless you try out.
John Powell is a mild-mannered geophysicist living in Brooklyn. In the 80s, when he was in the fourth grade, he made the team.
The youngest, smallest, lightest, newest, strongest All-America team.
I got an award, and I think Ronald Reagan's name was on it. I just vaguely remember competing with my friends, and then getting the certificate in the mail, and my mom being super happy about it.
For John, the test wasn't a source of anxiety. It wasn't really a test at all, more of a game. He was trying to beat his buddies, and he did.
Now that it's gone, what does this do to your sense of accomplishment?
I have no idea. See, I'm here at the park with my son, and he may never know about it, I guess. So I guess we'll have our own competitions. Yeah.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. We had some reporting help this week from Lee Gaines at Illinois Public Media. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu and Liz Tung. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.